This is Conversation. Two of the most famous paintings in Canada have only been executed in the past 5 years. One is titled At the Crease. It's an eye-filling canvas depicting a crouching hockey goaltender. That was finished in 1972. Pancho, a rain-soaked, yellow rain-coated figure, was another painting executed in 1973. Tonight, I'm in conversation with the painter of these masterworks, Ken Danby. The painter's life has been magnificently laid bare by art historian Paul Duval in the book titled Ken Danby, and published by Clark Irwin.
I prefer the categorization of painting. I'm a painter. I create paintings. I'm not aiming at magic, super, hyper, or any of the realisms, in quotation marks. I'm just simply creating paintings. Because I think if you lock yourself into that kind of category where you're doing a specific thing, you're really handicapping oneself in terms of flexibility. No, I'm a painter. I create paintings, and that's it.
Do you see yourself as a follower of anybody in particular? Because in your career, a real turnabout for you was Andrew Wyeth's material, a show that you saw 143 paintings or something, and then
it wasn't a turnabout really, but it was simply a confirmation of what was my instinctive approach to art. It has been described as being in the light of my being an abstract painter at that point, and seeing a Wyeth show and suddenly deciding that's what I should be doing. No way. In fact, what happened was when I came down from Sault Ste. Marie to Toronto, the age of 18, to become a student at the art college. My natural inclination to art was in a very realistic vein. I had no idea of what abstraction was all about, non-objective expressionism and so forth. I had no exposure to that in a Sioux. So the only way I wanted to approach art was realistically. But the Ontario College of Art at that time was very heavily, as any art center was in those days, very heavily into non-objective painting, and so therefore it was conveyed to me in many, many forms and ways that to be anything of an artist, one had to approach art in the current vogue or the current fashion, which was non-objectively. I tried to appreciate that and tried to work in that because, after all, I wanted to be achieving some kind of significance as a painter. But it was a frustrating thing for me all along. I appreciated, after a time, I appreciated the fundamentals and the validity of abstract art. But that in itself was not an end, a satisfying end for me. And over a period of time, even though I dabbled at it, and I would hardly refer to myself as being an abstract painter then, I was just out of school and dabbling at this and that. Certainly I did some abstract paintings in it for a period of about a couple of years there, but never being totally satisfied with it. So through that frustration, I just went back to doing what I wanted to do, which was work realistically, whether or not it was acceptable. But coincidentally, I happened to get to that Wyeth show, and there was a confirmation for me that what I wanted to do instinctively was in fact an appreciated and recognizable approach to art. So it wasn't a case of me switching from what I was doing, it was a case of my already having become frustrated with it as an end in itself, and simply being able to have a very important confirmation of what I would want to do anyway at an appropriate time.
Well, as Duval says, that you're never very far away from the abstract anyway, that the abstract is the basis for what you're doing in a realistic sense.
Very true. And I believe that experience in exploring abstract art, that experience in my dabbling in it, was a very great benefit to me because that allowed me to, it gained me a tremendous insight into what art was all about. Rather than just approaching images in a realistic way, I became very familiar with all of the facets of art, all of the individual facets of art, which abstraction investigated very thoroughly. And I was able to apply these particular directions into realism as well. So really, approaching art realistically or representationally, the image is one thing, but the the building, the structuring of it, is really quite a form of abstraction. So I incorporate abstraction very much into my work.
The difference, one of the main differences between your work and Alex Koval's work has been, his is a geometric basis, according
right.
to Duval,
that
geometry has a great deal to do with that. Cézanne is another one that...
Well, Koval, for instance, is quite a formal structuralist, almost a mathematician in paint, whereas I'm far more related to a romantic in that respect, that I approach it instinctively, and I approach my work intuitively. I don't structure anything mathematically at all.
You're not looking for cones and shapes and spheres and all that sort of thing that...
I just allow my intuition to have total freedom there, and if something instinctively bothers me or excites me, that is the direction that I pursue, rather than trying to formulate my approach to an image.
There are some paintings, for example, Pancho, which I thought was the name of the coat the guy was wearing. Reading your biography here, it says it's the name of the man you painted.
Right. Pancho was his nickname, and he was wearing a poncho.
Now correct me if poncho, or pancho, poncho.
Somewhere in
the it's not way. The name of the painting is not the name of the coat he's wearing.
No.
Okay.
Right.
See, then that's my fall down here because I'm not very good on spelling.
It's a common misconception, but it's almost a natural one. After all, it's something that you immediately look at. He's wearing a poncho, and it's called Pancho, and certainly quite a natural inclination to think that.
Now that painting, the conception of that painting goes back a few years.
Right, back in around 1970.
Where did you meet this man?
Actually, Pancho was a neighbor of ours, and we became very close friends. And the painting itself, the germination of the idea, we just happened one evening when we were going to visit Pancho and his family, and having just arrived in the house, I heard the door open behind me, and I turned around, and there was Pancho coming in from the fields. It was raining very hard that night, and he had just been doing some late plowing. And as I turned around, there was this very imposing gentleman, dripping wet, soaking wet, with his yellow raincoat on. And it
Is that ring bell?
No, nothing happened. I didn't just jump up and down and say, "Hang on, stand still, I've got to go and run and get my paint," or anything like that. It's just that I think everyone experiences this, where you encounter a situation or a person, and then when you think of that person, for whatever reason, you say, "Well, gee, I've got a party at Pancho's, or I've got a party at Jim's place," or whatever, and you think of that person. I think of that person or that experience visually, being visually oriented. And so the image of Pancho would always come into my mind in that circumstance. And over a period of 3 years, this image of Pancho kept recurring in my mind whenever I was just inclined to think of him for whatever reason. Eventually it became more and more predominant, more prevalent in my mind, and I thought, there obviously is a reason for it. That's probably an approach of painting Pancho I won't let go of. So I had him pose for me. And at that point, he no longer had the yellow raincoat. I had to acquire a yellow oilskin slicker. And of course, to achieve the water, I had to ask his indulgence for hours on end. I would pour buckets of water over his head and so on. And he just... the image resolved from, however, that original encounter, you see, and it took 3 years of fermentation almost before it was pursued to the point of satisfaction.
It has to repeat itself, though.
Yes. In other words,
the
idea has to keep floating, because if it sinks, it deserves to sink. The best concepts, the best ideas for a work just seem to naturally keep coming forth, whereas I suppose as a very young artist, I was always running around looking for what it should be I can approach in my work as a subject, and many years ago I realized that was no longer necessary, that I had more than enough sort of flowing into me and wanting to be done and fermenting, and germinating away on its own without me having to pursue it consciously.
Now this painting, the poncho, I zero in on that, I guess, like most people, because it's featured on the cover of the jacket of your book. It's been widely published. I think Weekend Magazine was one of them. I could be wrong about that. It could be the Canadian, whatever
Canadian,
it is.
Yeah.
Canadian. There was something about that painting, Colville's horse running into a train, and a few other paintings I could probably mention. What is there about those that grab my attention? These paintings stay with me. Can you think of any reason why that would be? Is it me, or is it something that seems to have hit everybody else? Because obviously other people have felt the same way about this painting of Poncho.
At the risk of seeming presumptuous, I would hope that it's because they're good paintings.
But can we analyze it any further than that?
Well, I think a good painting but certainly should possess many qualities, and one of them should be that in one form or another they should have a certain degree of potency, they should have a certain degree of strength to them. And whether that strength is an obvious one or a subtle one, that strength should be exuded in the work visually. And I think if it works, and if it's a good work of art, even painting, sculpture, piece of music, these are the strengths are what prevail in the end. And if it's a strong image, a strong work of art, a strong book or piece of music, it's going to sustain itself. It's going to click. It's going to excite the audience in one form or another. As often, this is simply the case of something surpassing mediocrity, something overcoming the norm, something a little more exceptional, perhaps.
You said that you wanted to be judged on all of your work in one shot. That's very hard to do, particularly when you have several paintings out of the lot that you've done that ring those bells with people.
And what I meant by that was that too often today we find it's a seasonal approach to art. An artist will have a show one year and then change his approach the next year and go on to another form, another fashion of art the following season. And I have never really had any doubts as to what I was pursuing and the direction of my work was going to take. So in terms of approaching the change and the evolution of what it is I'm doing in art, I would prefer to see an evaluation or an appraisal take place over a period of time in the body of work to see that it's evolving and changing subtly, not changing seasonally because of what's in vogue. So it's a case of, yes, my work is growing, yes, my work is evolving, but you're not going to see it in one show or in one season, in one exhibition. You're going to see it over a period of time. And something like this book, for instance, I think allows a person to say, to see the earlier work and then to appraise the improvement, I hope, in the later work, and to see the subtle changes take place, the refinements and the changes in approach and perhaps subject. But in other words, the growing of the art rather than the abrupt change for the sake of change.
Yeah, and art historians like to zero in on those points that change.
Right.
They assume, I think, probably, that they're the only ones who've noticed that.
Yeah.
And it gives them something for a thesis.
Well, this is art historians and art critics and reviewers have tended to be very critical of me, for instance, because they don't see great changes. They don't see immediate fluctuations in my approach from year to year. And it seems that they become accustomed to wanting to see that, and therefore, because they don't see me changing my approach every year, I would hope that they would look a little closer and see an evolving an evolution take place there, a growth take place rather than a change.
Hmm. think probably one of the reasons that they don't see the abrupt changes is that while you're prolific in what you do, it takes so long to do even one canvas.
True.
That you're not crunching them out three or four a month.
That's
or
right.
Probably more, in according to some of the artists. So you don't get a chance to be bored with what you're doing.
No, that's very true. My work physically just cannot be accomplished in a seasonal basis. It's very difficult for me to even create a show and have an exhibit once a year. Obviously, the pieces that require much more time just cannot be completed in that time span. So many things that, for instance, I have an exhibition on right now, and it's rather a modest show. There's some very good watercolors in it, but there's no major tempera work in it because the tempera work just had to be set into limbo in order to achieve something that was presentable to have an exhibit to coincide with the book. And while it was necessary to offer something in the way of exposing my work to coincide with the book, it just meant that none of the major pieces that I have in progress could be accomplished in time. And I just will not sacrifice the integrity of the work just to meet a calendar schedule. So even the one little temper that is in the show has to come back to the studio. I just didn't resolve it completely. And this is
so that one didn't get sold?
Oh yes, it was sold. It's very near completion. It's just I have a little infighting to do before I'm entirely happy with it. And any work that I pursue must be 100% satisfying before I can let it go. Any work of art that I do let go is, after all, representative of me for the rest of my life and thereafter. So it's got to work well before I'm content to part with it.
Duvall claims in his opening chapter his real reason for writing a book about you, a living artist, is because what's happening to people, art historians, for example, is that they are picking up the droppings behind the horse and trying to construct the horse by analyzing the ingredients in those droppings.
Sure, there's no better time to accurately depict what an artist is doing and what an artist is all about and so forth than when he's alive and able to converse and communicate his side of it or her side of it. Too often, an entirely different analysis is written or reviewed by being well after the fact, after the artist is gone, and everyone gets on the bandwagon and says, "Well, this is really what he was trying to do." Well, the artist is no longer around to clarify that.
Well, you've got letters to his mother.
Yeah.
to so from.
I think he's made a very valid point there, where he wants to take advantage of the fact that a person is alive, available, and quite willing to clarify and qualify the record. And if he wants to make it an accurate record, which a true art historian should be doing, involve the artist to that point and do it while the artist is available. Too often, we were discussing this yesterday, a whole direction of approach of an artist is misconstrued and misinterpreted because based on someone's opinion who really has no intimate knowledge of it, perhaps a relative even of an artist who certainly has a close tie in the sense that they're related, but they don't have any intimate knowledge of what it is the artist is pursuing. So here is a case of Duvall saying, let's get the record straight while the man is here.
How well do you think he's got you in this? Did you have any points of contention?
No, not really. I respect Paul Duvall very much. I think he's probably the art historian of Canada to the point that he is pursuing it, the direction that he has, and pursuing what has been, I think, as you realize, a very unfashionable art in the art community. And I think he deserves a lot of credit for his sticking to his guns and sticking his neck out.
Well, he rakes the critics over the coals quite quite neatly. He claims that realist painters have always been persecuted.
True.
Do you feel persecuted at times?
I don't feel persecuted, no.
You laugh all the way to the bank. I guess that's the old cliche.
No, it's not a case of laughing to the bank. It's just a case of, from my viewpoint, of what is it I'm trying to do? I'm an artist. I'm trying to communicate visually with people. What it is, therefore, I need to succeed at that is an audience. Contrary to the fallacy that has always prevailed, an artist doesn't paint for himself. Certainly, an artist should paint for personal satisfaction in achieving a success with a work of art. But the whole idea, the whole basis of that is to communicate visually with an audience, to have an audience respond to what you do. So my satisfaction is gained from the very fact that my audience does respond. There is an immediate response, generally in large numbers that respond to what I do. So financially has nothing to do with it, really. It's just that it's a very gratifying point that people do respond to my work.
The critics in Toronto have been very, very cruel, I think. The Toronto Telegram in 1970, the art critic wrote, Danby's art is of the calendar variety. That's a shot right to the heart.
Well, there's an immediate kind of resentment of what I find to be a very superficial approach and a very shallow approach to criticism.
If someone were to say, well, it looks, a photograph could do that. If one looks at the water droplets on the yellow poncho, I think they, and analyze that carefully, they'd find that's not very real at all.
Well,
I don't think you get water droplets like that. They usually run together or they're constantly in motion. To get them all to stop still like that would be a major feat of magic on your part, real magic realism.
But your original point there about photography is naturally a continual relation, related point with realistic painting. If a camera could do the job, what's the point? Well, the point is simply that that's based on the assumption that what you're looking at is exists. That in fact what you're seeing in the painting is a real entity, and it isn't. It's an abstraction from reality. It's simply that because it's done in a very realistic representational fashion, it's misinterpreted to be so lifelike that a camera could duplicate it, whereas that just never did exist. But through the creation of the artist's efforts, the abstraction and restructuring of reality through the artist's eyes. So it's an original creation based upon an experience that exists, perhaps, based upon a very directly derivative subject, but not a duplication. Now, there is a school of realism that is devoted to actually copying and duplicating every faded or out-of-focus element of a photograph. And they scrupulously and dedicatedly copy the photograph, and that is simply another direction of realism, another direction of approaching a realistic subject. But their aim there is to duplicate the idiosyncrasies of photography as a contemporary direction in realism. Here again, that's a direction that out of the structuring geometrical approach to realism, I am not very interested in. So you see, there are all kinds of directions of realism within the blanket concept of realist painting too. But no, photography just can't approach.
You wouldn't suggest that there is no art in photography.
No, though. Not at all. Art art is very broadly encompassing a term. And photography is simply another art form. And in the hands of an artist, it is certainly a fine art. But it's like any tool. A camera is a tool. A paintbrush is a tool. And it's the artist that makes it work or not work.
You occasionally use photographs?
I use photographs when I to pursue and feed information back to my studio. Certainly, I could never approach some of the things that I've done without the assistance of a camera. my goalie, or for instance, could never crouch that long for days on end to pose for me. But I need a great deal of accurate information to pursue the extent of my work. In other words, I take the image to such a degree of restructuring and clarity and detail that I need a lot of information to offer into the painting. And it's just another tool, you see. It's how well you use it and how well you are aware that it's a tool. If you start to rely on it as being an easy route, then inevitably the work will fail, because then you're letting the tool do its job instead of manipulating and controlling that tool.
You mentioned the goalie. The goalie, of course, is the one that's probably the most famous goalie,
right.
Even more famous than Ken Dryden in some circles.
It's not Ken Dryden, by the way.
No, it's not. Who is it?
It's a local goalie in Guelph that I had posed for me, and it doesn't represent him necessarily, or it doesn't represent a particular goalie. What intrigued me about that whole image initially was the mask. In other words, the mask was the catalyst that I continued to focus on, and that was the very ominous part of the image, the almost anonymous force slightly intimidating force that the image had. So the mask, I wanted to perhaps change slightly to emphasize that power that the image possessed. So the mask wasn't a duplication of the goalie's mask so much as a portion of the painting that allowed me to direct attention and create more force.
Some of the interesting things I saw, incidentally, the painting is called At the Crease,
right.
And it's probably one of the more famous paintings of yours now.
Right.
Does it have some sort of a Canadian nationalist feelings in you that as you were painting that? No?
No.
Just
no.
A subject?
A very strong subject, something that I had a strong empathy for. But no, I don't approach my work on the basis of being Canadian. I'm not consciously aware of trying to do something that's Canadian, never. No.
Who owns that painting? No.
That's in a private
collection.
Right.
Yeah. Some of them are named. Dan Rowan in Hollywood,
yep.
Dev Rowan in Martin.
Yep.
The last entry in the book is owned by Gordy Lightfoot in Toronto. It's a carousel, a horse.
Right, right.
A lot of people, a lot of Canadians, have a genuine Danby in their possession and perhaps don't know it. If they bought an Olympic coin with a canoeist or the rower,
right.
The lacrosse players and the bicycles,
right.
They have Danbys in their collection. I went out and bought two of the canoeists without knowing who did it. I just thought it was a marvelous coin, and I wanted.
Thank you.
It took me three banks to finally find anybody who had any left. And they didn't have the rower, they didn't have the lacrosse players, but I eventually got one large lacrosse player.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then I found out that I had genuine Danby. I was very pleased about that. The marvelous thing about it, of course, and I tell the listeners, if they can still find any one of these coins, they can have what normally would cost a few thousand dollars. For, I think the $5 coin probably is selling for at least 10 by now.
And
so they can have an original Danby in their possession.
And you can cash it in at any bank.
Thanks very much for coming to talk to us. Ken Danby, the book is written by Paul Duval, published by Clark Irwin.
Thank you very much, Bud.
This has been Conversation. Conversation tonight with Ken Danby. Conversation is a public affairs production of CJRT-FM.